Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas is Jeff Sebo. Thanks for being with us, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Tom, and it's great to be here.
Hey, Jeff, can you start out by telling our listeners how you got involved in animal issues?
Sure. I got involved in animal issues in college. I went to college back in 2001 to 2005, and I was not any more familiar with animal issues at that point than I think most other Americans are. But I took some philosophy and sociology classes and learned about animal ethics and about our treatment of animals. And I was really surprised by that. And I was also inspired by some of my professors at the time who were vegetarian or vegan. And I'd never met anybody before who held those values or practices. And it took me a little while, I would say about a year and a half or so after I initially heard and was persuaded by the arguments. But I eventually got there and made that change and became vegetarian and vegan. And because nobody else was organizing around animal issues, I organized a couple of animal advocacy organizations on campus. And so that was really the start of my identity as someone who studies animal issues and advocates around animal issues.
Well, we got, it's nice to have a Texas connection.
Yeah.
And at TCU, it doesn't strike me as a school that's, you know, particularly well known for that type of scholarship and work. So it's interesting that you were able to fall into it there.
Yeah. Interestingly, they do have some wonderful faculty members. And I do think they now have an animal studies program, which has been really exciting to see. So it might not have been something that I knew about them going in, but I got lucky and I found the right people, and they were really so helpful in teaching me about this stuff. I really appreciated that.
Yeah, it's interesting how campuses, you think, you know, you have in your mind that they're like very progressive and full of, you know, openness to ideas and discussion. And then when you find yourself there, you do get exposed to new ideas. And then sometimes even one person can make a huge difference on the whole climate of the campus if, you know, if they're effectively advocating something new, like for animal issues. Did you have a lot of people join your group?
Yeah, I think a lot of people might be an overstatement, but we definitely had a really great community of faculty and students from different departments, and especially the philosophy department and also English and sociology. And so we had a nice little community, and we took a lot of classes together and worked on projects together and did fundraisers and protests and campaigns. And it was really great education, both about animal issues and philosophical issues, but also about how to do activism and advocacy and fundraising and some of those forms of engagement effectively.
Right. And you know, as a professor now, it looks, you know, like a lot of your research is focused on animal ethics and bioethics and environmental ethics. I imagine there's a fair amount of overlap between the subjects, but I think for maybe people who are less well-versed in animal ethics, how would you provide a synopsis of that and perhaps why it matters and you know, why you've chosen that as a path?
Yeah, so animal ethics is what you might imagine the ethics of human relationships with and treatment of non-human animals. And why it matters is because there are, of course, many non-human animals in the world. There are about 8 billion humans and quintillions of non-humans, so they outnumber us by many orders of magnitude. And they also experience a lot of pain and suffering, both because of human activity and because of natural causes, ranging from about 100 billion animals per year killed unnecessarily in factory farms, 1 to 3 trillion killed unnecessarily each year in industrial fishing, and then countless animals killed in the wild, both because of other animals and hunger and thirst and illness and injury, but then also increasingly human causes like pandemics and climate change and deforestation and development. So both because of the scale and neglectedness of this issue and increasingly the tractability of this issue, I think it deserves a lot more attention than it receives. As to why I got into it, I think I got into it partly because of what I just mentioned, that the scale and neglectedness and tractability and increasing human complicity in domesticated and wild animal suffering makes it, I think, an incredibly important high priority ethical issue. But also I got into it because I kind of lucked into it. I worked on these issues in college because I was inspired by people who was working on them. And then around the end of grad school, I was lucky enough to get a job developing this undergraduate animal studies program at New York University, and that really gave me this wonderful opportunity to really focus on this topic and develop my research and teaching in that direction. And I think it was partly just because of that very lucky opportunity that I was able to push farther in this direction.
Well, it's great that you are, because it's a topic that isn't covered, you know, on most campuses, I would say. And like you said, the scale of human impacts on animals has never probably been greater. And hopefully, if people get educated, they can think more about how their actions really do impact other animals on this planet. And, you know, that's one thing that we talk about here on the radio show quite a bit, is how just the decisions you make every day and choosing what you eat has enormous ramifications on animal welfare, environmental health of our planet, and your own ethical well-being, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. Yeah, it has not been a very common topic on campuses, but that is starting to change. More colleges and universities are starting to create these animal studies programs that study what animals are like and our relationships with and treatment of them from multidisciplinary perspectives. And there are more people doing your kind of work, doing advocacy and education on TV and radio and podcasts. And I really think the more we can represent animals in education, and the more we can represent animals in advocacy in the media, and then collaborate and coordinate across these different platforms, I think the more progress we can make.
Yeah, and I think it seems like it's going to be also becoming more and more popular and gaining traction because of all the intersectional issues that are at play when it comes to animals, and how, you know, you have some scholarship in climate change that we should talk about here shortly. But, you know, part of many shows ago, we had a guest who talked about the conflicts over in the future that are going to be over access to water, and how it's a threat to you know, and the challenges that's going to create to a military and the people that served in armed forces. And you have people who are, you know, all the health issues from people who don't have access to clean air, or the poor communities, and often the environmental racism that's associated with, you know, these pig farms in places like North Carolina. You know, there's really just so many, you know, for people that, you know, try to chalk it up as, oh, well, it's just animals. And, you know, I think there's this, you know, and I guess you may get this from time to time, is this idea of, well, it's evolution, you know, like they tend to themselves, you know, as if, you know, they operate in a vacuum. But yeah, I mean, I'm hoping that that's perhaps going to, you know, the hope for the future is that people are seeing that there's so many ways in which how we treat animals impacts so many other things that are instrumental for our lives.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you have covered the water issue and environmental racism and some of those other topics. Those connections are so important to talk about. And maybe we can talk about some of them more today too, if you want to. And the main thing I would add to that is that means it really is important to think about these topics holistically and structurally. There can be this temptation for us each to focus on our issue and let other people focus on their issues. But there really is value if we can all work on our issue in a way that is mindful of impacts with respect to other issues too, because then we can really start to find those connections across all of these cause areas and look for shared solutions to shared problems, and look for structural changes that can address multiple oppressions or multiple harms at the same time. And so I think that is really where we need to be heading.
Yeah, I agree that if we could identify some commonalities there that would identify roots of the problem and help people learn about those, it would be so helpful. And that's why I kind of brought up the personal diet choice, because I mean, that one does tie into so many of these issues, and it's something that people should be thinking about more and more as we hear, you know, about needing to have a healthy diet to maintain our own health in the face of things like this pandemic we're in. You know, we want to have the healthiest body and immune system that you can have. So it seems like an excellent time for people to open up a little bit more to some of these synergistic issues.
I would like to think so. Yeah. And of course, there are important implications, not only for individual health, but also for public health, right? In addition to wanting to eat food that can be healthful for yourself, we also want to be supporting food systems that are helpful for local communities and the global community, because as we might talk about, industrial animal agriculture is a leading contributor to the risk of global pandemics like COVID-19. And so both for our own health, but also for community health, global health, I think supporting these food systems, plant-based food systems is very important.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's I think many people are still trying to wrap their heads around, you know, how we treat animals does contribute to pandemics. And, maybe you can speak to, a little bit to that.
Yeah, so there are many ways our treatment of animals contributes to pandemics, and I can give you a few examples. So most pandemics in recent memory do seem to have come from human exploitation or extermination of non-human animals in one way or another, and COVID-19 is no exception. It seems from what we can tell that COVID-19 originated in animals, perhaps bats, and then might have gone to another intermediary animal, maybe a pangolin, and then gone to humans from there in a live market, a wet market in Wuhan, China. And in general, the wildlife trade is not only a huge cause of animal suffering, but also a huge cause of the spread of zoonotic diseases, because humans are taking wild animals from their natural environments, making them travel in unsanitary, stressful conditions across great distances, and then exposing them to new human and non-human animals. And that facilitates the spread of zoonotic diseases, as seems to have happened with COVID-19. So the wildlife trade is a major cause of the spread of zoonotic diseases, both in non-human populations and then also with human populations. In addition to that, deforestation is a leading contributor to the risk of pandemics, because when you cut down a bunch of trees and you destroy biodiversity, you expose humans to more zoonotic diseases, both because you force animals to look for somewhere else to live, and then that causes them to encounter humans more, but then also with less biodiversity comes fewer buffers between human and non-human animals, and that too increases the spread of zoonotic diseases. And then perhaps most importantly, factory farming increases the risk of zoonotic diseases and pandemics, because with factory farms, basically you are breeding animals to have weakened immune systems, because you breed them to grow as big as possible, as fast as possible, in spite of the bad health impacts it can have for them. Then you cram thousands of them together in a windowless shed, basically, and you keep them there until you are ready to transport them for slaughter. And so this is basically a perfect breeding ground for antimicrobial resistant pathogens. You have a bunch of sick animals in close proximity to each other, spreading diseases and living in their own waste. And then on top of that, a common practice in factory farming is to give the animals high quantities of antibiotics and other antimicrobials, both because you have no chance of providing individualized veterinary care for that many animals at the same time. And so you have to give them antibiotics and antimicrobials to suppress the spread of disease, but then also to stimulate growth. And so when you combine all of these things together, creating animals with weakened immune systems, putting them all in close proximity to each other, giving them a bunch of antimicrobials, this is the perfect breeding ground for antimicrobial resistant pathogens, pathogens that will be immune to our current ways of dealing with pathogens. And then you distribute them globally. And so this imposes risks on the animals, on workers, on local communities, and on consumers. And then, of course, indirectly on economies, as we've now seen with COVID-19. So the wildlife trade, deforestation, factory farming, all of these forms of extermination and exploitation are not only bad for animals, but also very bad for global health.
Well, and also in the factory farm situation, you have these animals that are basically, you know, you're killing them and their guts are being opened and splayed out in workers in those situations are, that's another risk.
Yeah, and it connects with your point about environmental racism, because it will typically be low-income communities, including low-income communities of color, where factory farms and slaughterhouses are located, because anybody who has political power will want to keep those types of facilities out of their backyard. And it will also be people who lack other job options who end up being employed in factory farms and slaughterhouses. And they can be exposed not only to those health risks, but also to other illnesses and injuries, and there can be emotional impacts and physical health impacts without the kind of compensation they would need and without the kind of legal and political resources they would need in order to advocate for themselves. So there really are very troubling impacts for workers as well as the animals and the broader communities.
Yeah, we've certainly see that in the way that some of these slaughterhouses have responded to the pandemic, COVID, and their desire to stay open, their lack of protections for some of the workers, for making it difficult for people to leave the job for a day even for fear of being fired. Right. And so it's you know, it really speaks. And then while at the same time we have the government trying to speed up the slaughter lines so that they can kill more animals per minute at a greater danger to all the employees in an already dangerous work setting. And so there's, you know, definitely, as going back to Liz's point, there's a direct correlation between the choices that we make and the products that we buy and the foods that we eat and its impact on an individual's, you know, life, or, you know, loss of limbs, or, you know, death to COVID, or loss of job due to COVID. It's really just so sad on so many fronts. And one that, you know, the economy, you know, people are like, oh, well, we can't, you know, we have to prop up these industries and keep them going. We have to support, you know, these policies that allow these slaughterhouses and industrial animal agriculture to continue. But it's like, at what cost? You know, we've seen the huge economic impact that COVID has had on the loss of jobs and right. You know, it's really just, you just don't understand why people aren't taking it more serious yet.
Yeah. It really is sad and so incredibly irresponsible to be supporting industrial animal agriculture right now. I mean, anytime, and especially right now, when it can increase the spread of COVID as well as increase the risk of future pandemics. The fact that our president used the Defense Authorization Act in order to protect slaughterhouses and keep slaughterhouses open rather than supporting the opposite kind of system and other essential workers who can be properly protected on the job was you know, incredibly irresponsible. But of course, that might have been par for the course.
In your book, Food, Animals, and the Environment, and sort of right. going back to your deforestation point, I think a lot of people think, oh, well, I recycle paper, or I, you know, I'm not buying old growth forest products anymore, and so I'm not contributing. But, you know, we forget that most of that land is cleared is either to allow cattle to graze or two, to grow crops that actually feed cattle. And again, it's just right. one more way in which those decisions are impacting our health and animals directly.
Yeah, and this is related to the climate. It's such a good point, and related to the climate change point too, because one climate change related impact that often gets lost in discussions about agriculture is this point about deforestation. A lot of people think, okay, maybe hamburgers contribute to climate change, but they focus on cows and methane and think, oh, maybe we can genetically engineer cows to burp less methane and that will address the relationship between animal agriculture and climate change. But while that might mitigate some of the methane emissions to a degree, it will not at all address the more significant issue of deforestation and development, because deforestation is going to destroy these forests that have captured and stored carbon, which both releases carbon dioxide, currently stored carbon dioxide, into the atmosphere, and reduces the land's ability to capture and store more carbon dioxide in the future. And so if we really want to think about the health and environmental impacts of agriculture, we have to think about these issues holistically and not try to reduce it to cows and methane, but really think about all of the activities that prop up this food system and the climate impacts of all of them together.
Well, just to switch gears in our last few minutes here, I wanted to ask you about, you know, when we started talking about, you know, your path to animal advocacy, and you were talking about how much pain and suffering animals go through, you know, due to human exploitation, and directly or indirectly. I was wondering, do you think people would be more swayed if we focused more on the joy and the empathy and the other emotions that even scientists are saying now are more and more common in species of animals that we never gave those attributes to before?
I love that question. Thank you for asking that. That is such a good point and something that animal welfare scientists and philosophers are starting to think about more, because you are right to say that scientists and philosophers have so far focused mostly on the negative aspects of consciousness and sentience in non-human animals. We note that animals can feel pain and suffering, and we should care about them on that basis because we can cause them pain and suffering, or we can relieve their pain and suffering. And I think that is true and important, but it neglects the fact that animals can also experience pleasure and happiness, and they can have projects and relationships and lives that are meaningful to them in similar ways, in different ways than our lives are meaningful to us. And if we want a full understanding of who animals are and why animals matter, we absolutely need to be focusing not only on the negative, but also on the positive aspects of consciousness and sentience. And just to give a quick plug, my colleague at NYU, Becca Franks, has really been a leader in this space, especially when it comes to aquatic animals. She does a lot of work on positive welfare, positive well-being in aquatic animals, and it might be worth talking to her at some point about that.
Yeah, sometimes I think, you know, people have so much empathy and for their companion animals, and then boom, it just cuts off right there. So every time I see a story in the news, like I saw something today about how kangaroos can ask for humans for help, you know, I don't see why people get so surprised about these connections between species when we know in the natural world, these connections are very important for survival and reproductive success. So I, you know, this, that's one thing about, you know, always, I try to always emphasize that, you know, we humans are animals and we get a lot of our, you know, evolutionary traits from our ancestry, right? And so trying to get people to get that kind of perspective seems like it would be super important to make faster progress.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there are many reasons why we make these distinctions among animals. I mean, certainly we are speciesist, and then we also apply these labels to animals and classify some of them as family and others as food and others as part of the natural scenery. And then we assign expectations and assumptions to them on that basis. And those social and psychological forces can be so incredibly powerful. And so I think there is probably no single silver bullet that will help us overcome all of those biases and heuristics. So I think, you know, thinking about positive welfare is very good, very important, and probably not enough, right? It has to come with all sorts of other things, like efforts to show that animals are individuals with individual personalities, and efforts to reduce our dependence on systems that harm animals for food and research and entertainment and so on and so forth. And if we do all those things at the same time, then I think we can clear a lot of the obstacles that are making it harder than it should be to see animals as individuals who can have positive lives.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, we only have a few minutes here left, but I did, and this sort of, I think, ties in well, is that you've also written about, you know, effective animal advocacy. And, you know, we don't have a ton of time to talk about it, but, you know, based on what you've written, you know, what do you think, where do you think us, in light of all the world, what's going on in the world right now, and how we want to contribute to fight climate change and help, you know, communities facing, you know, this environmental racism and improve water and air quality, things that come with, you know, animal advocacy. What do you think are maybe some of the strengths and areas that we should be focusing on?
Yeah, great question. And I know time is limited, so I can try to give you a quick answer. So I think animal advocacy is a really important part of a broader advocacy project for the reasons that you mentioned. Animals are important in and of themselves because there are so many of them. The scale and neglectedness, again, of animal suffering is astonishing. And so we should be prioritizing animal issues in part for the sake of the animals themselves, but also because our use of animals is central to a lot of global catastrophic threats that are impacting humans too. Our use of animals is contributing to pandemics. Our use of animals is contributing to climate change, to land and water scarcity, to natural resource scarcity. And of course, our othering of animals, our treatment of animals as other and lesser than, is deeply entangled with our treatment of other humans as other and lesser than. And for all of these reasons, if we want to treat animals better for their own sake, if we want to reduce the risk of global catastrophic threats like pandemics and climate change, if we want to get at the root cause of systems of oppression that create self-other categories and oppress others on the basis of membership in those categories, then bringing animals into our advocacy is a good thing to do. And so it should not be the only thing we do, but I hope that increasingly it can be part of what we all do in our advocacy.
That's well said, for sure. And Jeff, where can our listeners go to learn more about your books and your other scholarship, which are really is just it's just a plethora of great material that I think so many people would benefit from reading.
People can find me pretty easily by Googling me. My name is Jeff Sebo, S as in Sam, E, B as in boy, O. My website is jeffsebo.net, and you can also find me on Twitter and other places like that.
We've been talking with Jeff Sebo. Thanks for making the time, Jeff. Hope you had a wonderful holiday season, and we wish you well in the new year.
Yeah, you too. Thanks so much again for doing this and for having me. This is a great conversation, and I hope you have had a happy holiday season too.